White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew, welcome to Chapter 61 tonight on September 26, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
And we have a great chapter to read tonight. It's very powerful. I'm sure you'll agree with me when you hear it. And it's long, too, so that means it's not as much time for us to discuss about it. But that's the way it goes. The title is Jewish Power in America's Money Famine. And it might help to know that there was a major depression, or maybe it's a minor. I don't think it was a minor, but they call it a depression in the United States during 1920-1921, during which time there was a money crisis in regional banks throughout the country. But as we learn, not in New York banks. So pay attention, because there's a lot to learn in this chapter. All right, Hattie?
Okay.
All right.
Pay attention.
All right. You go ahead.
All right. Jewish Power and America's Money Famine. The international Jewish banker who has no country but plays them all against one another, and the international Jewish proletariat that roams from land to land in search of a peculiar type of economic opportunity, are not figments of the imagination, except to the non-Jew who prefers a lazy laxity of mind. Of these classes of Jews, one or both are at the heart of the problems that disturb the world today. The immigration problem is Jewish. The money question is Jewish. The tie-up of world politics is Jewish. The terms of the peace treaty are Jewish. The diplomacy of the world is Jewish. The moral question in movies and theaters is Jewish. The mystery of the illicit liquor business is Jewish. Illicit because they had prohibition at the time. Mm. These facts are unfortunate as well as unpleasant for the Jew. And it is squarely up to him to deal with the facts and not waste time in trying to destroy those who define the facts. These facts are interpreted by the Jew and the anti-Semite with strange extremes of blindness. The Jew never gets the world's point of view at all. He always gets the anti-Semitic point of view. And the anti-Semite is equally at fault in always getting the Jew's point of view. What both need is to get society's point of view, which is the one being set forth in this present series of articles. To say that the immigration problem is Jewish does not mean that Jews must be prohibited entry into any country. It means that they must become rooted to a country in loyal citizenship, as no doubt some are, and as no doubt most are not. To say that the money question is Jewish does not mean that Jews must get out of finance. It means that they must rid finance of the Jewish idea, which has always been to use money to get a stranglehold on men and business concerns, instead of using finance to help general business. To say that the tie-up of world politics is Jewish does not mean that Jews, as human beings, are to be denied a voice in affairs. It means that They must give up trying to make the world revolve around the Jewish nation as its axis. To describe the influence of the Jew on the theater is not to demand that he leave the theater, but it is to demand that he rid the theater of his idea that sensualism is entertaining.
Well, see, I think that they're going through all this. I think they know better. But because of this, they go so far in this chapter, I think, against the Jew, that they want to set up in ahead of time, once again, that they're not anti-Semites and that they want the Jews to, you know, take the lead in changing what these worst Jews are doing. But they do say use the word most, you know. And the fact is that when the Jew stops being a Jew, then he'll be able to do these things they want him to do. But until then, he's never going to do these things. So it's just, you know, it's just kind of a way to start things out, is what I think.
Well, what they're saying is, in effect, that they're not reacting to Jews as such, but to certain facts.
That's right. That's right. And they want to make that real clear. And it's a good thing that they do because, you know, the fact is that we do, although if to be just honest, though, you do, we do have to get Jews out of finance. We do have to get Jews out of movie and whatever else they call it, theater. And we do have to get Jews out of all these things. There's no way. We know now, 100 years later, that we do, for sure. Anyway.
The Jewish question is first for the Jews to solve. If not, the world will have to solve it for them. They may stay in business, say the theater, for example, if they will cease spoiling the theater. If they do not cease, the theater will be taken away from them just as certainly as that day follows night, as that day follows night. The world has been patient and the world will be fair, but the world knows the limit of imposition. That sounds like what happened in Germany.
Well, yeah, and you see, we know now that the world does not know the limit of imposition. And the world's not going to do anything about it unless people, you know, make a decision differently. I mean, they're saying like, well, it's just going to happen if these Jews keep going the way they're going. But, you know, it hasn't happened. And actually, they've beaten all the rest of us. They've beaten us.
Yeah. Yeah, a little too much faith in popular reaction.
Always. There's always that. And, you know, it's a shame it doesn't happen. Somebody's got to drum
it up. The fact that the Jews control mass media tends to take that, tends to foil that tendency for popular reaction to correct things.
Well, right.
Because they can use mass media to misdirect.
Well, they use everything that they are in control of to make it impossible to do anything about it. I mean, that's the way they go about it. But
yeah, but mass media is the main thing.
Well, I don't know. We're talking about finance here, you know. We're going to see how bad it is in the financial world.
It is not the true Jewishness of the Jew, nor yet the nationalism of the Jew that is on trial, but his anti-national internationalism. A true Mosaic Jew, not a Talmud Jew, would be a good citizen. A nationalist Jew would at least be logical. But an international Jew has proved an abomination because his internationalism is focused on his own racial nationalism, which in turn is founded on his ingrained belief that the rest of humanity is inferior to him and, by right, his prey. Jewish leaders may indulge in all the platitudes they possess. The fact which they cannot deny is that the Jew has for centuries regarded the Goyim as beneath him and legitimately his spoil. The internationalism of the Jew is confessed everywhere by him. Listen to a German banker. Imagine the slow, oily voice in which he said, "We are international bankers. Germany has lost the war. What of it? That is an affair of the army. We are international bankers. We are international bankers." And that was the attitude of every international Jewish banker during the war. The nations were in strife. What of it? It was like a Dempsey-Carpenter bout in New Jersey or a baseball game in Chicago, an affair of the fighters. We are international bankers. A nation is being hamstrung by artificial exchange rates, another by the sucking of money out of its channels of trade. What of it to the international banker? He has his own game to play. Hard times bring more plums tumbling off the tree into the baskets of the international bankers than does any other kind of times. Wars and panics are the Jewish international bankers' harvests. Citizens wake up with a start to find that even the white nations are hardly allowed to see each other nowadays, except through Jewish eyes. When the United States supposedly speaks to France, through whom does she speak? All that France sees is Otto H. Kahn. Why must a Jew represent the United States of America to France? When France supposedly speaks to the United States, through whom is it done? Through Viviani, Jewish in every thought and method. Now they are talking of sending Millerand over, another Jew. Britain sends Lord Reading. Germany sent Dr. Dernberg. And to other countries, the United States sent Morgenthau, Strauss, Warburg, and lesser Jewlings. It comes with something of a shock to learn that Foch is coming to the United States. We have not seen a Frenchman since Joffre visited us. It is good to see men of the white race come across the sea, as if to reassure us that white men still live in those countries. The business of the peace conference was done by Jews. Has it come to a point where international diplomacy is to become a Jewish monopoly also? Must the special conversations between France, Britain, and the United States be held through Jewish interpreters, while Anglo-Saxons and true Frenchmen do the routine embassy work? Or shall it be possible for the non-Jewish nations to see one another occasionally through non-Jewish representatives?
That's pretty amazing for that time. You know, we're talking like that now, but they were saying this then, 1921.
Internationalism is not a Jewish conviction, but a Jewish business device. It is most profitable. In diplomacy and at the immigrant station, internationalism pays. Jews interpret nation to nation in the high rights of special conversations between governments. Jews interpret nation to nation in the high rights of special conversations between governments. Jewish interpreters swarm at the ports of every country also, where the poor swarm in. It was stated in the House of Lords the other day that most of the trouble in Palestine was caused by Jewish interpreters. It was charged that the Jewish administration added an extra language to the official list in order to make Jewish interpreters indispensable. Go through the government of the United States, where the income tax secrets are kept, where the Federal Reserve secrets are kept, where the State Department secrets are kept, and you will find Jews sitting at the very spot where international Jewry desires them to sit, and where nothing is kept from their knowledge. Go abroad and come back to your country, and a Jew will open the gate to let you in, or close it to keep you out as he chooses. Will you be going to Detroit while you are here? Asked a Jewish government agent of a gentleman entering the country on a visit a few weeks ago. I may go to Detroit, was the reply. Well, you go to the damn Dearborn Independent and tell them a Jew let you into this country, said the government agent. What the visitor replied is known, but had better not be quoted. The American Jewish Committee might shriek that the people were being incited to pogroms. The incident, however, is but a sample of what is occurring every day. The truth about the Jewish question in the United States is perhaps the one form of truth that cannot be indiscriminately told. The international Jewish bankers regard themselves as, in similar fashion, letting the nations do this or that, regarding the nations not as fatherlands, but as customers, and as customers in the Jewish sense. If an army wins or loses, if a government succeeds or fails, what of it? That is their affair. We are international bankers, and we win whoever loses. For international Jewish bankers, the war is not over. The period of actual hostilities and the emergencies of the nations were but the opening of the trade. The ready cash was skimmed in then, all the cash the world had. True, some of it had to be distributed among the people as war wages and bonuses in order to keep the struggle going, but this was soon recovered through the means of high prices, artificial scarcities, and the orgy of extravagance deliberately organized and stimulated among the people. Mm-hmm. That phase over, and money disappeared. Is there any more tragic joke than that diligently disseminated in this country? The United States has more gold than any other country in the world. Where is it? How long since you have seen a piece of gold? Where is all this gold? Is it locked up in the treasury of the United States government? Why, that government is in debt, desperately trying to economize. Cannot pay a soldier bonus because the finances of the country cannot stand it. Where is that gold? It may be in the United States, but it does not belong to the United States. The American farmer and those American industries which were not wise to the tricks of international Jewish bankers and who were nipped by small loans are wondering where all this money is. Furthermore, Europe, suffering from every possible lack, is looking to us and wondering where the money is. This dispatch in a London paper may throw light on the matter. Italics are ours. It is learned today that new gold shipments aggregating $2,800,000 are consigned to Kuhn, Loeb & Company, New York, making nearly $129 million imported by that firm since the movement started. In responsible banking circles, the belief is expressed that some of the German coin recently imported by the firm is from Russia instead of Germany, as generally supposed. This dispatch, coupled with one printed in a former article which showed Warburg and Company of Germany arranging with Kuhn, Loeb and Company of New York for a $5 million loan to Norway, is not devoid of light on the question, where is the money? The Jewish international banking system may be easily described. First, there is the International Jewish Headquarters. This was in Germany. It had ramifications in Russia, Italy, France, Great Britain, and the South American states. South American Jewry is very menacing. Germany and Russia were the two countries scheduled for punishment by the International Jewish Bankers, because these two countries were most aware of the Jew. They have been punished. That job is done. Jewish political headquarters, as related to the international affairs of the Jews.
Internal affairs.
Oh, internal affairs of the Jews, was also located in Germany. But the headquarters dealing with the Goyim was in France. Statements have been made that the political center of Jewry has been transplanted to the United States, but these statements have been made by American Jews whose wish may have been father to the thought. During the Wilson administration, it was possible for a Jew to think and to hope this, but affairs have slightly changed. The ousting of American Jews from the Zionist movement at the behest of Eastern Jews indicates that if the political center of world Jewry has shifted to the United States, the power is still in the hands of aliens resident here. The center is still in Jewry. The United States is merely a square on Jewry's world checkerboard. But wherever the financial and political world centers may be, each country is separately handled. In every country, the United States, Mexico, and the republics of South America, in France, England, Italy, Germany, Austria, yes, and in Japan, there is an international Jewish banking firm which stands at the head of the group for that country. Thus, the chief Jewish firm in the United States is Kuhn, Loeb and Company, of which one of the members is Paul M. Warburg, brother of M. Warburg and Company of Hamburg, and another member of which is Otto H. Kahn, resident successively of Germany, Great Britain, and the United States, and self-appointed financial spokesman for the United States to France and Great Britain. Great Britain and France seldom see a special American spokesman who is not a Jew. That may be the reason why they reciprocate by sending Jews to us, thinking perhaps that we prefer them.
That's funny.
Paul M. Warburg was the inventor, perfecter, and director of the Federal Reserve System of the United States. He is not the only Jew in the Federal Reserve System, but he was the chief Jew there. His mind counted for a great deal. There were others in the war government, of course, Bernard M. Baruch, Eugene Meyer Jr., Hoover's Regiment of Jews, Felix Frankfurter, Julius Rosenwald, hundreds of them, and everywhere. But the financial group alone is receiving our attention just now, and they are not so notably successful in getting the country out of financial difficulty as they were in other lines of effort. The Federal Reserve System may not be a bad system, in spite of the fact that it yields government monetary functions to private financial corporations, but there are all sorts of testimony that it has been badly manipulated. Mr. Warburg, the reader will remember, spoke about certain things being overcome in an administrative way, showing that there was a certain amount of play or loose motion in the system which could be manipulated either way. The fact remains that the country went swimmingly through the war by reason of the assistance of the system and is coming very lamely through the peace. As the result, monetary experts say, of the hindrance of the same system. Mr. Warburg, whose name was so prominently connected with the advertisement of the glory of the system, must also stand being mentioned in connection with the criticism. Whatever money we are said to have as the per capita in the United States, it is a false statement. The money per capita should always be figured on the basis of the money in circulation. The statistical per capita is not always in circulation. Less than half of it, as a rule. The rest is being juggled. Whatever the gold in the country, the wealth is still greater. There is more wealth in the United States than there is gold in the world. 1 year's products of the farms of the United States exceeds in money value all the gold in the world. Yet, under our present system, the burgeoning bulk of the country's wealth must pass through the narrow neck of money, and the money must pass through the still narrower neck of gold. And the controller of the gold, under our present system, controls the world. There is more wealth than there is money. There is more money than there is gold. Money exists at the pleasure of gold. Wealth moves at the pleasure of money. Whoever sits at the neck of money, opening or closing as he will, controls the movement of the world's wealth. And the world's prosperity depends on the movement of that wealth. When wealth stands still and does not pass from hand to hand, the world's circulation has stopped. The world becomes economically sick.
Well, the one who stands at the neck of money, sits at the neck of money, are the central banks. Correct? That's how I read this.
Yes, I suppose so.
Central banks they're talking about, yeah. Of which we just got our central bank not too long before the time they're writing about here.
Correct.
Right.
The scarcity of cash in hand has led to credit. Credit is a form of barter. It is a form of dealing by which many transactions are carried on, only the final one being cleared in money. It is a device which has its dangers, in spite of the efforts of apologists to exploit its advantages. But one thing the system of credit indubitably does, it allows the money masters to hang on to the cash. When the world is caught with paper, not with cash. The cash is always in the hands of those who extol the advantage of the credit system. Who holds money holds power, and will hold it, until real barter, or real money, comes in fashion again. In 1919-1920, according to one of the best monetary authorities in the United States, the total shrinkage in values of the products of our fields, mines, factories, mills, and forests represented a sum greater than the total gold supply of the world. Shrinkage in values. It runs as high as the total amount of Liberty Bonds outstanding. People will say, well, the prices were too high. Certainly they were too high, but who and what made them too high? It was the generosity with which money was supplied by the private Federal Reserve system. There was plenty of money. People say, well, the shrinkage is only in paper values. The real value of the product is still there. Certainly, but when you live under a system in which real value and money value are so intimately intertwined that it affects your bread and butter, the tenure of your farm and the steadiness of your job, it is pretty hard to separate the two. Moreover, when your prosperity was due to the readiness of a group of men to let out money, and your adversity is due to the unwillingness of the same group, and your own welfare and your country's welfare is thus seesawed up and down without any reference to natural law, but solely upon determinations taken in committee rooms, you naturally inquire, who is doing this? Where is all the money gone? Who is holding it? Here is the wealth of the country. Here is the need of the country. Where is the money to transfer the wealth to the need? Every condition remains as it was, except money. We have a Federal Reserve System which still is benefiting by the assistance of its perfecter and director, Paul M. Warburg. And what is the condition in the United States? Some of the biggest industrial institutions in the country, now in the hands of creditors' committees. Oh, he's making a statement there. What is the condition in the United States? Some of the biggest industrial institutions in the country, now in the hands of creditors' committees. Farmers being sold out by the hundreds, their horses bringing about $3 each. Cotton and wool enough to clothe the nation, spoiling in the hands of the men who raised it and cannot dispose of it. Every line of business, railroading, newspaper publishing, storekeeping, manufacturing, agriculture, business, building. Depression. Why? For lack of money.
Well, this is the depression now that's going on at the time they're writing this. Still going on. And, go ahead.
He says lack of money, but it's really caused by overproduction.
Well, you say that, but I've been reading about this depression, and they were not lending out. They say they were not lending out money. Their money was very, very tight, and so people couldn't get loans to farmers and business people and so on. And they say here, they started out here saying, biggest industrial institutions in the country, some of them, are in the hands of creditors' committees. So, you know, there was a... I've got some information on this, but I'm going to wait till we finish the chapter and make sure we finish it.
This is why
Hitler's system worked better. Hitler started a system that worked much better than this central banking system.
Okay. You need to learn about capitalist overproduction. It's the reason why...
You know, you've talked about it. I understand capitalist overproduction, but I don't think that this was the reason for this depression.
Well, he's talking about farmers not being able to sell their cotton. Why do you think they couldn't sell their cotton? It's because there was too much.
It says that there was enough, but they couldn't dispose of it because nobody could buy it. There was no money. Okay. Let's see what they say here.
Where is the money? This is the country that is supposed to be the financial center of the world. Where is the money? It is in New York. The Federal Reserve System, which Mr. Warburg desired to head up in one central bank, has just about turned out that way. The money is in New York. Here is the charge made to the governor of the Federal Reserve Board by a responsible public official who knows. While there is a scarcity of money for the producing sections of the West and Northwest, the South and Southeast,
we find that individual banks in New York City are borrowing from the reserve system in a number of cases more than $100 million each. And sometimes as much as $145 million is loaned there to a single bank, twice as much as some of the reserve banks have been lending recently to all the member banks in their districts. One bank in New York borrowed
Continuing with the responsible public official. One bank in New York borrowed $134 million or $20 million more than the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City was advancing to 1,091 member banks in that reserve district, which covers the states of Kansas, Nebraska, Colorado, Wyoming, and parts of Missouri, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. At the same time, another New York bank was borrowing from the Federal Reserve Bank about $40 million, which was more than the aggregate loans which the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis was lending to its 1,000 member banks in the great states of Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Montana, and part of Wisconsin. Another New York bank borrowed from the Federal Reserve Bank a sum which was greater by $30 million than the Federal Reserve Bank at Dallas was lending to all the banks in Texas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma. Still another New York bank got a loan which equaled the total loans allowed by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis to the 569 member banks of that very important district, which includes the whole state of Arkansas, parts of Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Mississippi, and a larger part of Missouri. Take the Fifth Federal Reserve District, served by the Federal Reserve Bank at Richmond, Virginia. One New York bank was able to borrow from the New York Reserve Bank more than the Richmond Reserve Bank would lend to all its member banks in Maryland, Virginia, North and South Carolina, and the larger part of West Virginia. That is the situation. The 12 regional banks, which were supposed to make money serve all parts of the country equally, have apparently been overcome in an administrative way, to such an extent that the New York Federal Reserve Bank is to all intents and purposes the central bank of the United States and serves the speculative part of the country with millions, while the productive part of the country is permitted to wilt with paltry thousands.
Yeah, let me just make clear to the listeners that the speculative part of the country is like what we call Wall Street, you know, the New York Financial District and so on. And all these New York banks, they were getting this huge amounts of money, and the rest of the country was dealing in paltry sums in comparison. So that's pretty amazing.
When it can occur that four New York banks can borrow from the New York Federal Reserve Bank as much money as the banks of 21 states were able to borrow from the five Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis, Kansas City, Minneapolis, Dallas, and Richmond, there would seem to be need of explanation somewhere. Where did this money loaned in New York come from? It came from those parts of the country where money was scarcest. In May 1920, the word went out over telephones, "The tie-up will come on the 15th." And it came. Credit was stopped. Payment was pressed. A stream of money, literally squeezed out of the producing sections of the country, began to roll toward New York. Otherwise, those giant loans just recorded would have been impossible. It was pressure, Federal Reserve pressure, politely known as deflation, and that is the way it worked. The banks of the West were squeezed dry that the banks of New York might overflow.
The money was withdrawn from legitimate business in various parts of the country to be loaned at fancy rates in Wall Street, says the official referred to above.
The speculative banks, it has been discovered, were able to borrow money at 6%, which money they loaned at as high as 20, 25, and 30%. Federal Reserve deflation created a scarcity which speculative banks utilized. The Federal Reserve policy took the money out. New York banks borrowed the money thus taken out and loaned it at tremendous rates, rates which people paid to stave off the ruin caused by the moneyless condition which the ill-measured deflation process brought on. And all this time, the Federal Reserve System was in the best financial condition of its whole career. In December 1920, it had 45% of its reserves, which was a higher reserve than it had in December 1919, But at this writing, July 1921, the reserve has reached 60%. The money is in New York. Go out through the agricultural states, and you will not find it. Go into the districts of silent factories, and you will not find it. It is in New York. The Warburg Federal Reserve has deflated the country. A system that was intended to equalize the ups and downs of financial weather has been used in an administrative way to deplete the country of money. The Federal Reserve idea was doubtless right. If it had not been, it could not have been established. But it has been manipulated. It has not been a federal reserve. It has been a private reserve. It has been operated in the interest of bankers and not of everyone in general. Capable of being used to carry the country gradually back to a natural flow of business and to a natural level of prices, it was used to bludgeon business at a critical time and to bludgeon it in such a way that moneylenders profited when producers suffered. If that is the fact, there is no American banker but will say that the method was wrong, economically wrong, logically wrong, commercially wrong, if not criminally wrong. Today,
but it was criminally wrong. I mean, morally wrong. Okay, sorry.
Well,
morally,
he said that the word went out when the pinch on money was going to come. That would be what we call today insider
right.
trading, I suppose,
right.
or something
That's
like
right.
that.
Conspiracy
it's
right
a disruption
there.
Of the system. Insider trading was not illegal in the 1920s, I don't believe, but it is now anyway. But I'm sure it still goes on a massive scale. Today, the Federal Reserve boasts of its own reserve, as if that were a sign of national economic health. With the country struggling to live, the Federal Reserve ought to be low, not high. The height which the reserve has reached is a measure of the depth of the country's depression. If the Federal Reserve would let out a part of that flood of money, a high financial authority suggests that less than 10% would do it, it would be like an infusion of blood into the nation's veins. Kuhn, Loeb & Company, the Spires, and the other Jewish moneylenders have money for Mexico, Norway, Germany, and all sorts of commercial companies being organized to do business overseas, and it is American money. The Warburg Federal Reserve system has been badly misused, badly manipulated, and the country is suffering from it. Still, the people know not what to do. Money is still a mystery. Banking is still sacrosanct. What would be perfectly apparent if done in ordinary business intercourse with a $5 bill is exceedingly complicated when the sum is 5 millions and the parties are 1, country banks, 2, Federal Reserve banks, and 3, Wall Street speculative institutions. Yet they are only Tom, Dick, and Harry with a $5 bill after all. The matter is somewhat affected by the gags that are placed on many men competent to criticize. High officials are more or less tied up by campaign contributions in which all financial concerns have an interest. Legislative officials are, too many of them, indebted to these same interests. A schedule of the private debts of some of the men who have aspired to the presidency in the last 8 years would be very illuminating, almost as illuminating as a schedule of the names of Jews at whose homes they stayed while on journeys through the country. Many who are thus tied up with...
Men,
men who are thus tied up with the present financial system cannot say what in their minds they know. Of course, one of those that was indebted was Wilson.
Right.
Wilson had gotten bailed out by, Untermeyer, Samuel Untermeyer, because he had an illegitimate son, and the mother of the illegitimate son wanted money, or she was going to make noise. And I believe it was Untermeyer.
Well, they get these women to set up. I don't think these are natural and normal relationships, because probably that woman wouldn't have done that if she really cared about Wilson. But she was just set up by
people,
the Jews.
It's politics, like Bill Clinton, that can't.
Oh yeah, but you know, I think that even with Bill Clinton, it was set up that way.
There's no shortage of immoral men. Come on.
Well, you're pointing to the women. You know, the men, we don't have time to argue about this little thing. Another time.
It is all illustrated in the testimony of T. Cushing Daniel. Do you know who that is?
No, you said you were looking him up.
I was trying to find out, and I couldn't find anything, really. I saw some kind of blog post or something that said that he was the one that attributed to one of the Rothschilds a statement, let me control a nation's money supply and I care not who makes its laws. He's some writer, apparently, on banking. I mean, that's
okay.
The rumor.
Well, he must have been pretty well known back then, because they don't explain who he is.
Surprisingly, there's no Wikipedia entry about him. Mm-hmm. I, on short notice, I couldn't find anything. All right. Okay. It is all illustrated in the testimony of T. Cushing Daniel before a committee of Congress. It shows to what an extent the power of this private corporation called the Central Bank can reach. When going through the Bank of England, I presented a letter which I had from Secretary Hay. And the official of the bank was very polite. He took me through the bank, and when we got back to the reception room, I asked him if he would allow me to put a few leading questions to him. He said he would, and I asked him if he would give me a statement of the Bank of England. We do not issue statements. Does not the House of Parliament sometimes call on you for some statement as to the condition of the bank? No, sir, they do not call on us. How is it that some of these revolutionists, so-called, do not get up in the House of Commons and raise the devil to know something about what is going on down here? That would be the condition in our country.
In our country, he means in the U.S.
In our country,
he thinks so.
Oh, most of them are large borrowers from the bank, and we have no difficulty with them.
Laughter.
Yeah.
Yeah. These were Englishmen. You failed to use your English accent there. This is the Bank of England.
I'm not sure if T. Cushing Daniel is English.
No, but he told this to Congress, and he was.
Yes,
the one
well, I don't
went.
Know. If-
He went to the Bank of England, and he went in there and asked these questions of the Bank of England. Okay, you know, we're done with this, but you know, I've got some interesting information here I want to read. And first, I'm going to go back up, and then you can comment on it if you want. Let's see, where's my? Oh, and I've went too far. I'm all over. Can't go up. I go up to the two chapters before this. Okay. Here, you know, this depression of 1920-21, it says that, Wikipedia, there was a high unemployment, and it was, there were two researchers, people who judged, I don't know if they were economists or what they were, judged, what the unemployment percentage was. And one was a lot lower to start with and then went up real high and then real low, and the other one was more even. across from the 1919 to 1923. But the one, Lebergott, said in 1914 it was the unemployment rate was 1.4%. Then it went up to 5.2 in 1920 and all the way to 11.7 in 1921, down to 6.7 in 1922 and 2.4 in 1923. That's real sharp. This other one, Romer, said it started in 1919 at 3%, and then in 1920 jumped to 5.2. In 1921, up to 8.7, that was the high. And then 1922, down to 6.9. And 1923, down to 4.8. But it's, you know, there was high unemployment. And, let's see what else here. And, there was an extremely sharp decline in industrial production. From May 1920 to July 1921, automobile production declined by 60%. And total industrial production by 30%. Of course, this was a short, quick drop and came back again. But so I guess I don't know if these are big numbers, but I don't know if it's bigger than other things, you know, other times that we've experienced this. And rebounded quickly, but the most it had this recession. It's either both called a recession and a depression of 1920, 1921. Had the most severe decline, the most robust recovery of any recession between 1899 and the Great Depression. And it had the largest drop in business activity of any recession between 1873 and the Great Depression.
Yeah.
So that was that. If you want to comment on
that. Well, what they did is they solved it by doing what this book here demands, which is releasing money, which, you know, basically caused a credit bubble. See, that's what we've been doing.
Well, yeah, that's right. But that's because you've got that, things are being manipulated by these aliens who don't give a damn about the health of the country.
Yeah, it isn't all the aliens' fault. Aliens were profiteering from the situation, but the capitalist overproduction occurs even where you don't have Jews.
Okay. You want to attack capitalism. That's all right. Let me read this next thing here, and then you can go ahead with that. I just want to say that these bankers people are literally, and I think this chapter shows it, literally robbers and thieves. You know, and why do we worry so much about common criminals and what they're doing when these people in high places are robbing us out of house and home, and that's the truth. Now, currently, we've got this problem with the Federal Reserve, that we've got this deal with quantitative easing that Bernanke installed, that says was going to, you know, somehow keep the economy from crashing after the 2007-2008 debacle. And then he had to install this quantitative easing. That means they're putting $85 billion every month into the American economy, that they're just printing up this money, or, you know, they just change it digitally. But, you know, he was going to drop it, but now this person, John Malden, says that the meaning of the Fed's decision to continue with the quantitative easing for the time being signaled that it's no longer an emergency government measure, but it's now a permanent government program, in exactly the same way that retirement and poverty insurance became permanent government programs in the aftermath of the Great Depression. So now is deflation and growth insurance on its way to becoming a permanent government program in the aftermath of this most recent Great Recession, which we're still in. The rate of asset purchases may wax and wane in the years to come and might even be negative for short periods of time, but the program itself will never be unwound. And then another fellow from somebody else I was reading said, this is a guy from the Sovereign Society, Jeff Opdyke, wrote this, and this fellow that I read likes his work. And he wrote, quote, few people accept the fact that America is a bankrupt nation, They still buy into the nostalgic and tattered belief that America is a financial powerhouse, the richest nation on the planet. But wow. Just because some children think Scooby-Doo is real doesn't magically make him so. A few numbers to cement the point. Washington, D.C. has accumulated in our name. Now, that's the important part. This is all in our name. Roughly $17 trillion in debt. That's huge, but it's not the real debt. Throw in all the off-balance sheet promises politicians have made in pursuing their reelection dreams. Add all the money due to retirees in the Social Security system and all the debts wrapped up in Medicare, Medicaid, prescription drug plan liabilities, and you get a number that exceeds $125 trillion. Our tax revenues, basically America's paycheck, are about $2.7 trillion annually. So our debt-to-income ratio is 4,660%. Tell me, if you're earning the median income in America of $52,100 and your household debts exceed $242.6 million, which is a debt-to-income ratio of that same 4,660%, are you bankrupt or is everything going well? So, you know, this the idea that we can appear, I mean, we can appear to be going along, but, you know, all this debt is owed in one way or another. It's, I mean, not one way or another. It's all owed whether we're ever going to do anything with it or not, but it's all owed by the citizens of this country. So there's no benefit. What do we get out of being American citizens? I mean, we get currently we have all these programs that take care of people. But we're all in debt, and eventually, you know, we're not true beneficiaries of anything, and it's all being taken. It's all going to the Jews, and their banks.
It's all going to the Jews.
It has to be. Who else is getting any of it? We're talking about $125 trillion. That's beyond.
Well, the Chinese supposedly own a large part of the federal debt, and after that, the Japanese. But I don't know.
That's the 17 trillion debt. That's not this 125 trillion that is owed to all these.
You're counting Social Security as part of the debt, but that's owed to Americans, and that the United States of America is not going to go broke from the redistribution of money from one segment of the population to another. That is not wealthy, right? That money is still going to stay in the economy. So, I mean, the person who treated those things as equivalent is wrong.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if he's wrong or not, but I don't know if you're a better economist than some of these people. But you think he's wrong. Wait, I'll let you finish. We got 30 seconds.
Well, the worst thing about the debt is that it amounts to a redistribution of wealth from poor to rich because everybody pays the interest and whatever is paid on the debt through taxes. But the people who have lent the money are people who already had huge amounts of disposable income. So it's a redistribution from poor to rich. And we ought to cancel the debt. And it's shameful that the Republicans want to make keeping up those debt payments the top priority because we're talking about what can happen.
Okay. All right. We got to go. Thanks, ladies and gentlemen. Come back next week.
Rage, rage, I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.